Well, Senator, will you commit to accepting the election results of 2024, bottom line?
Well, at the end of the day, the 47th president of the United States will be President Donald Trump, and I'm excited to give back to low inflation, low unemployment.
Wait, Senator, yes or no? Yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024 no matter who wins?
That is my statement.
But is it just yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024?
I look forward to President Trump being the 47th president. Kristen, you could ask him multiple times.
But Senator, just a yes or no answer.
So the American people, the American people will make the decision.
But I don't hear you committing
for President Trump. That's that clear.
I don't hear you committing to the election results.
Here's the deal.
Will you commit to accepting the election results?
This is why so many Americans believe that NBC is an extension of the Democrat Party. At the end of the day, I've said what I've said, and I know that the American people, their voices will be heard, and I believe that President Trump will be our next president. It's that simple.
Oh, man. It's going to be a long year, but good luck, Senator Scott.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. That, of course, was Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina that you heard at the top of the show auditioning for the vice presidency along with Donald Trump over the weekend on NBC's Meet the Press.
Yes, that was Tim Scott saying, yeah, I'm not going to answer your question. Simply yes or no? Nope, sorry.
Not when it comes to whether they will accept the election results or not. Now, to be fair, it's not entirely reasonable to ask someone whether they'll accept the election results until they've actually seen the results, not to find out who won, but to find out to make sure there's no trouble in the election.
Yes, of course. But I think it'd be better stated to say, will you accept the will of the voters?
There you go. Yeah. You should. Hey, Desi Doyen.
Maybe
you
should
be
that.
The new host of Meet the Press. Meet the Press. I like that. All right. Anyway, welcome to the broadcast. Let's start here. Let's start 8 years ago next month on June 23 of 2016 in Great Britain. A radical referendum backed by far-right so-called conservatives was held to determine if the UK would break away from the rest of the European Union. The so-called Brexit initiative seemed so absurd at the time that really few took it seriously. And then it won. And then a whole bunch of folks realized that something was brewing in Europe when it came to the anti-immigrant, libertarian, populist right. At the time, the day that Brexit passed, in fact, I covered it on this program as a warning for what was perhaps happening in this country as well, and what could happen in November of that year, in that year's presidential election, with Trump then all but set to be the Republican Party nominee, even as, just as with Brexit, Few at that point had been taking him seriously. Few thinking that he would actually win that year. We try to dispel folks of that notion, but too little avail on this show. But pay attention to Brexit, I tried to warn at the time, as Trump subsequently, yes, went on to shock the world with his own victory that November over Hillary Clinton. And so that vote in Britain that year turned out to be an omen for what would happen in this country, even if few in the mainstream media really took note at the time. Over the past week in the UK, elections were held again last week, smaller, more local elections, but elections that, if you wish, could offer an omen for this year's elections in the U.S., even if the situations aren't quite as apples-to-apples analogous as they sort of may have been regarding the U.K.'s 2016 Brexit vote that served, certainly in retrospect, as a precursor for a similar right-wing so-called populist uprising that was to come in the U.S. that fall just months later. So, make of this what you will. On Saturday, Britain's Liberal Labour Party won mayoral elections in London and central England in crushing defeats, according to Reuters, for British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's unpopular Conservative Party ahead of a national election that is due later this year. While Labour politician Sadiq Khan's re-election as London mayor was widely expected, Labour also snatched a surprise, if narrow, victory in Britain's second-largest city of Birmingham. The wins are Labour's latest in local elections to councils and mayoralties and could fuel fresh calls for Sunak to step down as the fifth Conservative Party Prime Minister to hold that post since the disastrous passage of Brexit in 2016. Opinion polls are now predicting that Labour will win the next national election, propelling Keir Starmer to power and ending 14 years of Conservative Party government in Britain. Prime Minister Sunak has said he intends to call a vote in the second half of this year. That election may offer a broader example of whether we could look to Great Britain this year as a place where voters finally stand up and push back against an increasingly authoritarian right wing. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, perhaps Britain's next prime minister, said the results of the recent elections over the weekend was beyond Labour's expectations. Quote, people across the country have had enough of conservative chaos and decline and voted for change with Labour, he said in a statement. Sunak had been counting on getting an electoral boost from recent announcements on defense spending and the progress of his divisive plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. A remain in Rwanda plan, if you will, not unlike Trump's promised remain in Mexico plan, but the voters rejected that. Sorry, Mr. Sunak. Mayor Sadiq Khan's victory in London, meanwhile, his third in a row, came despite some public anger over crime and the ultra-low emission zone that charges drivers of older, more polluting vehicles a daily fee. Did you know about that one, Desi
Doyen?
Yes,
and it's also done a good job of cleaning up London's polluted air.
Mm-hmm. So action over climate change did not result in voters pushing him out.
It did
for
not.
It, I guess.
What a concept.
We will have more on related issues later this hour, I'm sorry to say. The 53-year-old Khan became the first Muslim mayor of the British capital in 2016. Yes, the same year as Brexit. Quote, we faced a campaign of nonstop negativity, Khan said in a speech after the results this weekend showed that he had won by a nearly 11-point margin over the Conservative Party candidate Susan Hall, a 69-year-old Donald Trump fan who made a series of gaffes and faced accusations of racism after being found to have engaged with far-right content online. Yep, sounds like a Donald Trump fan. For the last 8 years, Mayor Khan said in his victory speech, London has been swimming against the tide of a Tory conservative government, and now with a Labour Party that's ready to govern under Keir Starmer, it's time for Rishi Sunak to give the public a choice, he said, referring to national elections. An election must be held, national election must be held by law before the end of January 2025, though it's expected that Sunak will call for a general election earlier than that, at some point in 2024, perhaps in the fall, before our own elections here in the U.S. I will leave it to you to decide whether you wish to see the elections this past weekend in the U.K. as an encouraging sign for our own elections this fall, just as the Brexit election right around this time in the election year of 2016 turned out to be a bad omen. But if you choose to see what happened in the U.K. as a good sign, let me perhaps slightly bunk your high on that by noting that in elections in Panama over the weekend, Jose Raul Mulino, the guy selected at the last minute as a stand-in for former President Ricardo Martinelli in Panama's presidential election, appears set now to become the Central American nation's new leader, as authorities unofficially called the race Sunday night after his three nearest rivals conceded. Mulino, in the four-way race, won by more than 9 points over his nearest competitor after the nation's high court on Friday determined that, yes, he was eligible for the ballot, even though he had not run in any primary elections. He was chosen by his party to take the place of President Martinelli, Panama's anti-immigrant firebrand and former leader who was banned from running for president after being sentenced to 10 years in prison for money laundering. Imagine that. If you are convicted of a felony crime, some countries don't let you run to be their president.
What?
Interesting idea.
Are they okay?
Interesting idea. Mulino, who is apparently a less charismatic politician than Martinelli, coasted on Martinelli's popularity and the booming economy seen under the former leader as Martinelli campaigned while staying in the Nicaraguan embassy where he is seeking asylum after being charged on money laundering for 10 years in jail. And yet the people of Panama said, sounds great to me. Let's get the guy who he likes to replace him. Anyway, also an interesting idea, by the way, for perhaps a former president in this country who could be convicted by the time we get to November 5th, the idea of taking asylum in a foreign embassy here.
Yeah, like, I don't know, Russia?
I don't know. Just saying. Just spitballing. Spitballing ideas. So, you know, liberals won in the UK for now, after pushing back against years of right-wing chaos, and the right-wing populists won in Panama with their former firebrand leader barred from the ballot after being sentenced to 10 years for crimes of financial fraud. So choose your own adventure. Choose your own omen at this point. We will get back to our own elections in a bit, but in other overseas news today, Israel moved on Sunday to shut down local operations of Al Jazeera, the influential Qatari-based news network, in an unusual step that critics denounced as anti-democratic and part of a broader crackdown on dissent over Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Al Jazeera, a major source of news in the Arab world that has often highlighted civilian suffering in Gaza, of harming Israel's security and inciting violence against its soldiers. Israeli officials, however, did not immediately provide any example of Al Jazeera content that it claimed posed a threat, according to the New York Times report on this. In a statement, Al Jazeera called the decision a, quote, criminal act, and said that, quote, Israel's suppression of the free speech to cover up its crimes has not deterred us from performing our duty, unquote. The shutdown order is initially for 45 days with the option of a 45-day extension, according to the Ministry of Communications in Israel. It is directed at halting Al Jazeera's ability to transmit from Israel and to be seen there at all. Netanyahu and other Israeli officials have called the network a, quote, mouthpiece for Hamas, which led the October 7 attacks on Israel from Gaza that set off the war. That day, Al Jazeera repeatedly covered statements from Hamas officials calling for a violent uprising in the West Bank. But while there was concern that the closure might have a chilling effect on other news outlets in Israel, it was unclear if it would have much practical effect beyond Israeli boundaries. Quote, does anyone understand what they even want? Asked Ida Tuma Sliman, an Arab member of Israel's parliament, noting that Israel's Arab minority have been watching Al Jazeera for decades, and yet they have not taken up arms against the state. It's a slippery slope, she said, pointing to the government's diminishing tolerance for freedom of expression, noting, today it's Al Jazeera, tomorrow it'll be who knows who. Pointing to the government's diminishing tolerance for freedom of expression, journalism organizations on Sunday denounced the closure of Al Jazeera as a blow to press freedom. Reporters Without Borders strongly condemned the decision, which it called repressive. The Foreign Press Association, representing Israeli and Palestinian journalists working for the international news media, said Israel had joined, quote, a dubious club of authoritarian governments that have banned the station. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel, an independent human rights organization, petitioned Israel's Supreme Court to halt the measure against Al Jazeera, saying that it had witnessed attempts to limit freedom of the press and freedom of protest in Israel throughout this war. Israel's communications minister said in a video statement that the network's equipment would be confiscated. So not only are they not allowed to broadcast, not allowed to report,
they're going to dismantle their ability to do so in the future.
Yeah, taking their actual equipment.
Wow.
The Israeli police accompanied government officials who confiscated equipment at an Al Jazeera office at a hotel in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem and closed the office down. Israel's main cable provider said that it had stopped carrying the network, and the communications ministry said in a statement that access to Al Jazeera's internet sites would also be blocked, a measure that appeared to have come into effect on Sunday night. So if you live in Israel or if you use the Israeli provider, you can't even go read their website, the Al Jazeera website at this point. The timing of the closure raised questions with critics contending that Mr. Netanyahu might have been acting on political interests rather than on matters of national security. Oh, you think? Qatar, which helps fund the network, has been helping to mediate ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas, which includes the release of hostages seized in Israel on October 7. On Sunday, Israel's National Unity Party, which is led by Benny Gantz, a centrist member of Israel's war cabinet, said in a statement that it supported the move against Al Jazeera but questioned its timing. The party said that the timing could, quote, sabotage the negotiations for a ceasefire and the return of hostages, and that the decision stemmed from, quote, political considerations, a possible reference to Netanyahu's need to mollify hardline members of his governing coalition. The war in Gaza has taken a toll on Al Jazeera's own employees and their families. In October, for example, the Gaza bureau chief of the network's Arabic language service was told live on air that his wife, a son, a daughter, and an infant grandson had been killed in central Gaza, where they had been sheltering. And then in January, his eldest son was killed in an Israeli airstrike, according to the authorities in Gaza. Other news out of the war is moving very quickly today, but some of it is seemingly substantial, seemingly of note here. So pardon me if some of this becomes out of date by the time some of our listeners hear today's program. As I said, things are moving quite quickly. So as we go to air, some news out of Israel on several fronts. Early on Monday, the Hamas militant group said it had accepted an Egyptian-Qatari ceasefire proposal to halt the seven-month war with Israel. Now, that sounds like good news. It sounded like good news when a whole bunch of the news outlets were reporting on this. We had been waiting over the weekend. Apparently, Israel had presented a new offer, and representatives of Hamas were going to Qatar to give it a look and decide whether they agreed with it and whether they accepted it. And then we got the news early Monday that, yes, they accepted this proposal, but it is not clearly exactly what is in this particular proposal and if it includes all of Israel's demands. In recent days, Egyptian and Hamas officials have said that the ceasefire would take place via this proposal in a series of stages in which Hamas would release hostages it is holding in exchange for Israeli troop pullbacks from Gaza. It's not clear whether the deal will meet Hamas's key demand of bringing about an end to the war and a complete Israeli withdrawal. The two Middle Eastern nations, Qatar and Egypt, have been mediating months of talks between Israel and Hamas, and news of the apparent breakthrough resulted in celebration among Gazans, even as Israel later said that it was reviewing the proposal, but that it, quote, is not the framework Israel proposed. Signaling an actual agreement could still be quite a ways off, unfortunately. President Joe Biden reportedly spoke on Monday with Netanyahu and reiterated U.S. concerns about an invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. Biden said that a ceasefire with Hamas is the best way to protect the lives of Israeli hostages held in Gaza, according to a National Security Council spokesperson. But not long thereafter, Israel said that it will keep carrying out operations in Gaza as officials deliberate over this proposal. And during that same address, an Israeli spokesperson said that Israel would reopen a major crossing for humanitarian aid to pass into Gaza as soon as possible. That's good, but this spokesperson did not specify exactly when that crossing would be reopened. The White House had said earlier on Monday that Netanyahu had agreed to reopen the crossing during his phone call with President Biden. But then later on Monday, Israeli leaders approved a military operation in Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip city, and Israeli forces are now said to be striking targets in the area, according to Israeli officials, as we go to air, with Netanyahu's office saying that the proposal was, quote, far from Israel's essential demands, unquote, but that it would nonetheless send negotiators to continue talks on a ceasefire agreement. Those remarks, of course, come just days after Netanyahu had also said that he intended to attack Rafah with or without an agreement with Hamas to release the hostages. And so now, I guess, is once again the moment that I need to remind everyone that Benjamin Netanyahu, the right-wing prime minister of Israel, is wildly unpopular in Israel. And he was already facing, even before the war, several felony charges against him that he will, in theory, be tried for upon leaving office. And now, by the way, you can add to that potential war crimes that he may be facing after leaving office. So he has every reason, on a personal level, to keep this war going forever in order to avoid personal accountability. To the end that if any of these negotiations actually result in an end to the war, I will be stunned. I will be pleased, of course, very pleased, but I will be stunned. Netanyahu has every reason to keep this thing going as long as he can, because as soon as it ends, he's out of a job, he's in court, and he's potentially in jail, potentially for life at this point.
Yes, Netanyahu must stay in power in order to just stay out of prison.
And in one more piece of related news today, the Biden administration last week, according to Axios, put a hold on a shipment of U.S.-made ammunition to Israel. That, according to two Israeli officials who spoke to Axios about it. It is the first time since the October 7 attack that the U.S. has stopped a weapons shipment intended for the Israeli military. The incident raised serious concerns inside the Israeli government and sent officials scrambling to understand why the shipment was held, said these officials in Israel. President Biden has been facing sharp criticism among Americans who oppose his support of Israel. The administration in February asked Israel to provide assurances that U.S.-made weapons were being used in Gaza in accordance with international law. Israel provided a signed letter of assurances in March saying, oh, yeah, sure, totally. Everything we're doing is totally legal. The Israeli officials said that the ammo shipment to Israel was stopped last week, though the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the Israeli Prime Minister's office did not immediately respond to questions on the matter from Axios. So right now, it's largely two Israeli officials speaking anonymously to Axios. Netanyahu hinted at tensions with the Biden administration in a statement on Holocaust Remembrance Day that was issued on Sunday. Netanyahu said, quote, in the terrible Holocaust, there were great world leaders who stood by idly. Therefore, the first lesson of the Holocaust is if we do not defend ourselves, nobody will defend us. And if we need to stand alone, we will stand alone, he said. Last Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Israel and had a, quote, tough conversation with Netanyahu regarding a possible Israeli operation in Rafah, according to two sources. Blinken told Netanyahu during the meeting that, quote, a major military operation in Rafah would lead to the U.S. publicly opposing it and would negatively impact U.S.-Israeli relations. A day later, White House spokesperson John Kirby told reporters that Israeli leaders understand that President Biden, quote, is sincere when he talks about the possibility of changes to U.S. policy regarding the Gaza war, quote, should they move ahead with some sort of ground operation in Rafah that doesn't take into account the refugees living there. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. Now, that was a specific reference to a ground operation in Rafah. The reports we're getting in the hour or so before air that there are airstrikes happening in Rafah. Don't know if that would violate, I don't want to call it the U.S.'s red line here, but what the U.S. officials seem to be saying about what they expect from Israel. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said at a conference in Washington on Saturday that the Biden administration made clear to Israel that the way it will conduct an operation in Rafah will influence U.S. policy towards the Gaza war. That's sort of about where we are as of airtime in all of this. Like I said, a lot of stuff going on all at once, and whether you know, any of this, whether the Biden administration is actually going to finally put its foot down against Israel and what they are doing and the way they are treating these, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians in Rafah, in Gaza, that all remains to be seen. If Israel is in any way serious about some sort of an agreement for a ceasefire, an exchange of hostages, that remains to be seen. All of this quickly moving today, but sadly not quickly moving toward any final peaceful conclusion, it seems to me.
Yes, and as you mentioned, it doesn't sound like it's going to, in my opinion, based on Netanyahu's personal political peril that he is in.
Yeah. And I don't know why that's not covered more. I don't know why that's not mentioned more. He's in trouble. As soon as this war is over, he's out of a job. He's going to court. He's, to face the charges before the war started, and now to face potentially international war crimes since the war has started. I really don't know why anybody takes Netanyahu seriously when he talks about peace, that how much they want peace and how much they hope they can strike an agreement to get back the hostages. I don't think he gives a damn. I think he, well, he might give a damn, but I think he wants his job more than he cares about peace. Quick break, and we are back with more news on a busy day today. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Good question. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. A lot of rain in, from Houston on, from Texas on down to
and
Central
around,
America and beyond.
Around the world.
Yeah, we will get to that in a moment. But Donald Trump was fined yet again on Monday by the judge overseeing his criminal trial on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to a porn star in order to help him win the 2016 presidential election. Justice Juan Merchan began the fourth week of Trump's trial in New York by adding the latest count of contempt of court to the 9 that the disgraced former president was previously found guilty of last week for violating his gag order that prevents him from attacking witnesses, jurors, and the family members of the court and the prosecutors. Justice Merchan reiterated yet again on Monday that he will have to consider jail time for Trump if he should violate the gag order yet again. Now, some may say, well, I thought he said that last time. It's true. He did say that last time last week when he found Trump guilty on 9 counts of criminal contempt. But the prosecutors had already submitted 4 more instances prior to Merchan coming out with his ruling. One of those instances was the one that I believe that Trump was slapped with today. So now, if it happens again, I guess Merchan really, really means it. Jail time is the only next option that he has, given that the state law allows a $1,000 fine for each instance of contempt or 30 days in jail. He doesn't, he can't fine him $100,000 or something that might actually hurt Donald Trump.
Yeah, he can't do it commensurate with the defendant's wealth, which is what he's asked New York State lawmakers to change so that it's more reasonable for people who are wealthy.
Well, it ain't going to change for now, so he's got only jail time as the next option. We'll see if Donald Trump starts behaving. I'm sure he will. On Monday, in the actual trial for the case, the Trump Organization's former controller and its accounts receivable officer both testified on the stand about the checks that were cut by the company and signed by Donald Trump himself over his first year of serving office as the president of the United States, checks that were meant to reimburse his then attorney, Michael Cohen, for the $130,000 payment that Cohen made to adult film star Stormy Daniels in the weeks just before the election to help cover up a sexual encounter that Daniels and Trump had years earlier, according to Daniels. That testimony is expected to be a precursor to testimony by Cohen himself, perhaps as early as this week. He served a year himself in federal prison on charges related to this very same thing, to these federal election crimes that New York state prosecutors say that Donald Trump was trying to hide with these payments. In a conspiracy that both Cohn and federal prosecutors said when Cohn was sentenced to a year in prison, both Cohn and the federal prosecutors said it was a scheme that was, quote, directed by Trump himself. More on that, no doubt, as the week progresses. But in just one of the many criminal trials that Trump faces and claims, in each one, he claims this, that it is part of the weaponization of Joe Biden's Justice Department against Republicans, and in particular against him. Never mind that this is a state case in New York that we're dealing with. It has nothing to do with the federal Justice Department in that regard, at least as far as prosecuting it. But it got harder still on Friday for Donald Trump to make that argument that this is all about the weaponization of the Justice Department against Republicans. At least one would think that what happened on Friday would make it harder. I guess if you live in MAGA land, reality no longer matters. But right. For those of us still in the reality-based community, you will recall a few months ago that that very same Justice Department that Trump says has been weaponized by Joe Biden to go against Republicans, that Justice Department brought criminal fraud and bribery charges against New Jersey's sitting U.S. Senator, Democratic Senator Bob Menendez and his wife. It's been weaponized against Republicans. Boy, it seems like they're doing a lousy job because they keep hitting Democrats. And on Friday, it happened again. The Justice Department announced that Democratic U.S. Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas and his wife were also indicted on conspiracy and bribery charges. They were taken into custody Friday in connection with the U.S. Department of Justice probe into the couple's ties to the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan and to a bank in Mexico. From 2014 to 2021, Cuellar and his wife allegedly accepted nearly $600,000 in bribes from an Azerbaijan-controlled energy company and a bank in Mexico. And in exchange, Cuellar agreed to advance the interests of the country and the bank in the U.S., according to the indictment. Among other things, Cuellar allegedly agreed to influence legislation favorable to Azerbaijan and to deliver a pro-Azerbaijan speech on the floor of the U.S. House. The indictment also alleges an Azerbaijani diplomat referred to Henry Cuellar in text messages as the boss, and also that a member of Cuellar's staff sent multiple emails to officials at the Department of State pressuring them to renew a U.S. passport for an Azerbaijani diplomat's daughter. Cuellar was at one time the co-chair of the Congressional Azerbaijan Caucus. Who knew there was one? In addition to bribery and conspiracy, the couple faced charges including wire fraud conspiracy, acting as agents of foreign principals, and money laundering. If convicted, they face up to decades in prison and forfeiture of any property linked to proceeds from the alleged scheme. The payments to the couple initially went through a Texas-based shell company owned by Imelda Cuellar, his wife, and two of the couple's children, according to the indictment. That company received payments from the Azerbaijan energy company of $25,000 per month under a, quote, sham contract, purportedly in exchange for unspecified strategic consulting and advising services. The indictment states, quote, in reality, the contract was a sham used to disguise and legitimate the corrupt agreement between Henry Cuellar and the government of Azerbaijan. Imelda Cuellar sent a falsified invoice. Oh, a falsified business document. A falsified invoice to the Azerbaijan Energy Company's Washington, D.C. office under the agreement, stating that her work was complete, when in fact, quote, the indictment says, Imelda Cuellar had performed little or no legitimate work under the contract. The couple made an initial appearance before a federal judge in Houston and were each released on $100,000 bond, the DOJ said. The longtime congressman who represents the border town of Laredo released a statement on Friday saying that he and his wife, Imelda, are, quote, innocent of these allegations. But yeah, sure, other than major bribery charges against sitting Democratic senators and congressmen and their wives, Joe Biden has totally weaponized his Justice Department to go after Republicans, as Trump is still pretending. And finally today, some disturbing climate crisis news. From both overseas and here at home, from over the weekend and continuing today, first in Brazil, the airport is shut down. Dozens of highways blocked. Most in the state capital are now without running water, and the death toll is already at 83 and sure to climb higher, according to Washington Post this afternoon. Even in a country increasingly inured to national disasters driven by climate change, the flooding that has slammed into Rio Grande do Sul, one of Brazil's most prosperous states, has badly shaken this nation of 215 million, with more than half the cities in the state now dealing with flooding and 20,000 people left homeless. Rio Grande do Sul has not just been damaged, it has been crippled, according to reports. Quote, "This is the worst disaster ever registered in the state of Rio Grande do Sul," according to the state's governor. In recent years, Brazil has grappled with a lot of natural disasters, record rains, devastating floods, intense droughts, deadly landslides. Political leaders and scientists there have never been shy about blaming climate change and calling for greater action. But the public this time appeared far more worried. Comments were far more urgent, according to the Post. During a flyover of the devastation on Sunday, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as just Lula, appeared openly moved. His mood was, quote, a mixture of agony and anger, said one advisor. He kept saying, oh, my God, look at this. After he landed, he held a meeting with senior congressional and judicial officials, saying Brazil needs to change how it approached climate disasters. He called for the creation of a national plan to prevent climatic accidents, tasking his top environmental lieutenant to begin forming a strategy. Quote, "We just have to stop running after disaster," Lula said. "We have to start preparing for what can happen." In a comment exclusively provided to the Post, Lula said he blamed the devastation in Rio Grande do Sul on the failures of the global community to respond to climate change. He said there was a, quote, historic debt. Poorer countries that have historically emitted few greenhouse gases, he said, are suffering due to the pollution of wealthier nations. Quote, "This was the third record flood in the same region of the country in less than a year," Lula told the Post. "We and the world need to prepare every day with more plans and resources to deal with extreme climate occurrences." In 10 days, Rio Grande do Sul was soaked by the equivalent of 3 months worth of rain. In just 10 days, the Guaíba River gushed its muddy waters into the city, submerged much of its cosmopolitan downtown. The base scenario in the city is not likely to change for several weeks. It could worsen. Meanwhile, temperatures are expected now to lower to 50 degrees in the coming days, increasing the risk of hypothermia as rains refuse to relent and cities teeter on the precipice of anarchy. You've heard us for years warning on our Green News report about what was coming. Well, surprise! The Post notes, resembling scenes from Houston post-Hurricane Harvey or New Orleans post-Katrina, people all over the flood zone are stranded atop roofs. Hospitals have no power. Widespread looting has broken out. A gas station exploded. Inmates at local prisons that suffered flooding have been released. With roads shut down and the airport closed until at least May 30, there are few means of escape. So if you are wondering what our climate change future is going to look like, well, boy, this sure sounds like it, don't it?
Yes, it does, sadly. I mean, it's something we've been talking about for literally years. And, of course, international climate negotiations have been trying to address this, that the poorest countries who did not contribute to climate change, like historically rich countries like the United States, the world's largest historical emitter, those poor countries are being hit first and worst by climate change, by what rich countries like the United States have inflicted upon them.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that there's no problem having consensus. Well, there's a little problem now with today's Republican Party. But in general, no problem getting a consensus among the parties in this country when we need to send tens, if not hundreds of billions overseas to fight wars.
To kill people with weapons that are made in the U.S., yes.
But come up with a few billion dollars to help, you know, countries like Brazil to face what they're dealing with thanks to nations like us. Well, that's a different story. On Friday and Saturday, one woman with her parents in a wealthy suburb documented on social media in Brazil her fears as the water rose. She said, quote, "I'm with two elderly people who can't climb up onto the roof. We're going to die drowned," she said. "Send help by the love of God." Well, the family was ultimately saved the next day as her mother showed signs of hypothermia. But panic and uncertainty are now rippling through the state as thousands live without power, access to the internet, or even potable water.
There's going to also be an issue with waterborne diseases because these floodwaters take, in some cases, weeks to recede.
And yet, I'm guessing this is the first time that many of our listeners may have even heard about this story. "It's chaos here," said journalist Kelly Matos. "I've never seen anything like it." She said she recently went to a market, didn't find a single bottle of water. Others are trying to bathe with sparkling water. "This is war. That is the word," she said. "It's hopelessness, civil unrest. The tsunami is here." So that was Brazil, and I don't know if it's a war or tsunami yet, but speaking of Hurricane Harvey flooding in Houston, a lot of reports I've seen out of the city over the weekend, Desi Doyen, out of the city of Houston, harken back to 2017 and that particularly terrible storm. Desi, I know you have been watching this one closely in your old home state of Texas. Things are not a hell of a lot better in Houston at this point.
Oh, no, they're
according
terrible.
To reports,
their floodwaters are still rising in some areas, although it does appear that most of the rivers around the Houston region have crested. So the floodwaters did close Texas schools in some areas on Monday. This came after days and days of relentless heavy rains that have pummeled the Houston area. They led to hundreds of water rescues and people, including people who were stranded on rooftops. That's how high the water rose.
Sounds familiar, don't it?
Yes. Officials reported hundreds of those over the weekend, especially around the Houston area. So far, only one death has been reported, a 4-year-old boy who died after being swept away when the car that he was being evacuated in got stuck in the fast rising waters. And that's just a reminder, folks, please don't drive through water. You don't know how fast it's rising. You don't know how fast it can rise around you. If you get stuck, just don't do it. Turn around.
And that's difficult in Houston, where aren't the highways sort of built to be the
The highways in many cities are built as flood controls, but you know, people sometimes ignore what officials say and they go ahead and use those flood channels to try to get out or get onto whatever they're doing. Don't do it. It's really just a bad idea. So there is some good news. Dry weather is ahead for the next several days. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, that's what they call the top elected official in the county. So Hidalgo lifted mandatory emergency evacuation orders on Monday. She had smartly issued those prior to the rainstorm because the National Weather Service gave an accurate forecast about how bad the rain was going to be on top of already saturated ground. So some roads are still flooded, though, so it could take, I don't know, a week or so for the floodwaters to recede. And yes, some officials were saying that the flooding in these areas around Houston is actually as bad or worse than Hurricane Harvey in 2017. Mm. Except this wasn't a hurricane.
this was just a weekend of rain. Yeah, just this is what just a regular old storm seems to be turning into at this point in Houston.
Yeah, so the National Weather Service said that some parts of the region in around Houston were hit with 11 inches of rain in a day. Mm. Other areas like near Lake Livingston, which is northeast of Houston, that got upwards of 2 feet of rain over the past week, and that water just had nowhere to go. In fact, it was so extreme that water reservoir managers in some areas were forced to release water from dams to release some of that pressure to make sure that the dams held, which also increased the flooding. And it also underscores something that we have been talking about for a while here, especially at the Green News Report, about how these extreme disasters are causing a home insurance crisis in a number of states, specifically in Florida, California, and Texas. A lot of insurance companies are raising home insurance premiums to very difficult levels, especially for people on fixed incomes to be able to afford. Some insurance companies are pulling out of states altogether. Here is a resident in Humble, Texas, talking about his neighborhood.
It's just disheartening with one of my neighbors. She got probably 4 foot of water in her house, and her flood insurance this year went up to $5,000, so she did not renew.
So she did not renew her flood insurance this year because she couldn't afford it, and now this hits.
I blame Joe Biden. How much you want to bet? How many of those people down there in Texas with that sort of news blaming Joe Biden for the increase in insurance? You hear it all
knows?
The time. As a matter of fact, we started that show with Tim Scott. He was talking about the how insurance is going up. How people can't afford it. Kellyanne Conway was on Real Time on HBO over the weekend talking about how people just can't afford it. They can't even afford insurance anymore. Well, why do you think that is? Because y'all did nothing for years and years about climate change and the warnings that were given other than to pretend they didn't exist, other than to pretend that people like Desi Doyen and me and actual scientists were just making this stuff up.
So two more things about this. Officials
get a little irritated.
I know.
Yeah,
it's really heartbreaking to know that these are individual families that are being destroyed. Their lives are being destroyed.
And they're being lied to about it.
And they're being lied to about it. Exactly. So anyway, the two things that are important to keep in mind here, officials around Houston also reminded residents to get their emergency preparations ready for hurricane season, which starts June 1 officially. So that's a good reminder for everyone who happens to be listening to this program to remember now is a fantastic time to take a moment to make sure that your emergency preparations are ready. You can go to the federal government has a great site with all kinds of ideas about what you might want to include in your emergency preparedness kit. You go to ready.gov. And, you know, really important things like that. Really good because, you know, these folks, they had a couple of days warning, but, you know, it's too late to get prepared when the storm actually hits. The other thing is that Lena Hidalgo, the county executive, said that officials are also now mobilizing to be ready to control an expected surge of mosquitoes in the region because these floodwaters are just going to be a mosquito bonanza.
Well, that'll be delightful. And, of course, they carry disease.
Yes.
In related news, thank you for that toss, Des. Here in Los Angeles, before we get out, those who wage war on mosquitoes are adding a weapon to their arsenal, writes NBC News. More mosquitoes. What? The Greater Los Angeles County Vector Control District last week launched a pilot program to release tens of thousands of irradiated lab-raised mosquitoes into the local environment. Here in LA, these mosquitoes are all male, which apparently do not bite, and they have been sterilized by radiation. So the hope is that they will find wild female mates, impregnate them with dead-end sperm, and thus render the resulting eggs worthless. The target is a particular species known as Aedes aegypti. That's Aedes, A-E-D-E-S, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which began to populate here in L.A. County in 2014, and as NBC News reports, have evolved to hone in on one thing, you and me. And yes, it has been getting worse and worse in recent years. They're characterized as aggressive nuisance spiders because they will bite you all day long, said Daniel Hahn, a professor in the University of Florida's Department of Entomology and Nematology, where they know a thing or two about mosquitoes down there. Aedes aegypti thrive in backyards and make their homes in small containers like bottle caps and dog bowls. They can carry worrisome diseases like yellow finger.
Yellow fever.
What did I say?
Finger.
Oh, yellow fever. I was looking at this next word trying to figure out. Chikungunya.
Oh,
chikungunya. Yeah. Something like Zika and dengue fever. Now, this did not used to be a thing here in L.A., which is what makes this the most maddening. It was great here in Los Angeles because, by and large, we had no mosquitoes due to our dry, cool climate. But experts report, thanks to the warmer and wetter climate due to climate change, well, we now have mosquitoes here in Los Angeles, too. So we're all as miserable as you folks everywhere else at this point. Quote, we know our residents are suffering, said Suzanne Clue, the general manager of the Greater Los Angeles County Vector Control District. The district on Thursday released about 20,000 sterile male mosquitoes dyed to appear fluorescent under a black light as part of its final pilot program test. Male Aedes aegypti mosquitoes don't bite, so experts say the program poses near zero risk to humans. Other than, you know, the idea of these mosquitoes developing into giant, genetically modified, radioactive mosquitoes which take over the city. But what could possibly go wrong?
I see a screenplay in that one. I do want to add a couple things
yes.
on this particular type of mosquito
yes.
that is an invasive species,
yes.
not natural to the U.S. They can thrive in just a teaspoonful of water. So, like, if you have an overturned bottle cap,
yep.
you could also have a mosquito vector in your backyard. And they can travel up to a mile. When they smell humans, they will come to find you. So it's really important to go through and make sure that you're as completely mosquito habitat free in your backyard and your home as you can be.
If all goes well, county officials say they will begin next month releasing up to 60,000 mosquitoes per week in targeted areas where the reports are the worst. The strategy is an example of the way humans are deploying novel technology to fight the spread of invasive mosquitoes and diseases they can carry as climate change, global trade, and urbanization propel the pests into new territory.
Thanks, climate change.
And thank you, Desi Doyen, our producer, and all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We hope we didn't ruin it too much. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Share it with folks you know, love, and hate. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button at bradblog.com or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Really, it takes about 30, 60 seconds at most. And you will be supporting our continued good works over your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.